This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
Good morning, everyone. Senate Commerce and Energy is now in session. I'd like to ask everyone to please take a seat if you haven't already and have your phones turned to silent. If you plan on testifying today, please make sure you sign in at the back of the room with the pages. Also, have the pages hand out any handouts you want to pass out to the committee. Lobbyists, just a reminder, please have your badges clearly visible, and all testimony will be addressed through the chair today. Welcome to those that are joining us online. We encourage your participation remotely. Please contact us through senatecommerce@sdlegislature.gov. Again, that is senatecommerce@sdlegislature.gov. Vanessa here is monitoring that throughout the day and throughout the committee. So at this time, I'd like the secretary to please call the roll.
Senators Foster.
Here.
Norstrup.
Here.
Schoenbeck.
Excuse.
Senator Schoenbeck.
Excuse.
Stalzer.
Here.
Steinauer.
Excused.
Thank you. Tobin.
Excused.
Thank you. Zygmunt.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here.
Crabtree.
Here.
We have 6 of 9 members. We do have a quorum.
Thank you. At this time, the chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting. Second. Moved by Zygmunt, seconded by Wheeler. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. At this time, I'd like the pages to come on up, share what's your, say where you're from and what your future plans are, and at least 2 quality jokes. I'm just kidding.
My name is Delaney Pruitt. I'm from Britton. I go to Britton Hecla High School, and next year I will be attending SDSU.
My name is Sequoia Altamirano. I'm a junior, and I attend Chamberlain High School, and I plan to major in political science.
My name is Brianna Roth. I'm a junior at Redfield High School, and I hope to attend Morningside University to study psychology.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thanks for joining us. As far as announcements today, we'll just touch briefly on the agenda. We will follow the agenda as it's listed. We will bring up HB 1113 from below the line at the end after we've heard HB 1074. So we'll start back at the top with that one when we get there. With that said, we will start with HB 1098, authorize the shipment of cigars to persons in this state under certain conditions and to provide a penalty. Representative Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Tim Reed, District 7. And today I bring before you House Bill 1098. There's a desire to allow the online purchase and direct-to-consumer shipment of cigars to consumers in South Dakota. Current law prohibits cigars from being shipped directly to consumers in South Dakota. Now, we're only one of 2 states that does not allow cigars to be shipped in to a person's address. So what does 1098 do? This bill constructs a new chapter of law permitting a direct-to-consumer cigar shipping program. Creating the program in a new chapter of law avoids any potential conflicts with the Master Settlement Agreement, which is very important for us to protect because of the revenue that we receive due to that agreement, and with a streamlined sales tax agreement. So it makes sure that we stay within the rules of streamline in collecting sales tax. Out-of-state entities that want to ship cigars to South Dakota consumers will have a legal system to do so. With the current 35% other tobacco products tax applied to either their wholesale cost, and that's just like everyone else does if it's a Main Street shop, or to their manufacturer's cost if they are manufacturing the cigar and before they ship it. The reason for that is I want to make it Main Street fair. And so everybody's paying the same taxes. So if you order a box of cigars from someone down in a company down in Florida, you're paying the same taxes get paid if you bought that box of cigars at a local cigar shop here in South Dakota. In-state entities that want to ship cigars to South Dakota consumers, so this is in-state, will have a legal system to do so and will not pay any additional other tobacco products tax if the tax has already been paid by a licensed South Dakota tobacco distributor or wholesaler. And so what that's saying is there's a really cool cigar shop in Deadwood. And if you go there when you're out in the hills and you like some of their cigar selection, this is set up so they can still ship directly to you, you know, from Deadwood to Sioux Falls or Deadwood to Brookings, wherever you live. So this is good for in-state cigar shops also. We're just saying that the tax, when they purchase the cigars that they're going to sell, that wholesale tax is paid right at that point. And so there's where they, you know, they wouldn't have to pay that extra tax. Well, I shouldn't say it's an extra tax, but they are ready to ship to you right away and just charge sales tax, where an out-of-state would have to make sure that excise tax got paid. This bill closely follows the model created in 2015 for direct-to-consumer wine shipping. And so that's kind of how I approached this bill. I went to revenue and I said, you know, because we did have a cigar bill last year. It failed on the House side where it started. And I said, why can't we do this just like we do wine to the revenue department? And that's where they said, well, we can write a statute that's like wine and make sure that we cover all of this. So they were very helpful in writing this statute. So this bill, what this bill does is creates a cigar shipper license. Okay, so they'll have, so someone out of state can apply for the license. It authorizes adults over 21 years of age to make remote purchases of cigars. Authorizes cigars to be shipped directly to consumers in our state, but it does require age verification at the point of sale. Okay, so they'll have to either get like a copy of your driver's license, or there's also systems out there that can help check that you're of age. And then when it's delivered to the residence or wherever it's delivered to, somebody that's 21 years or older has to sign for it, and you can't just drop it at the door. And so that's in here also. The package itself is also clearly labeled that someone has to be 21 to sign for this package and that it contains tobacco products. This taxes the cigars under our current other tobacco products excise tax scheme and includes penalties for violations. And then it would become effective on January 1st of 2022. And the reason for that is to give the revenue department time, you know, to enact the licensing, you know, how they go through the licensing and the forms and all that kind of stuff. So it wouldn't become effective until January 1st of 2022. So I ask for your support of House Bill 1098, and I will stand by for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reed. Are there further proponents for HB 1098? Further proponents? I know we have Mark Triplett online there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning, Senator Crabtree and committee. My name is Mark Triplett. I'm here today on behalf of the Cigar Association of America, here to speak in favor of House Bill 1098. We've been working with Representative Reed to make sure that 1098 does what it's intended to do. We have the same desire that Representative Reed expressed with the bill, that our members, which make up, by the way, 98% of the online sales of cigars nationwide by volume, we desire to be able to get back into Utah again. It's been 10 years. But we also want to make sure that this bill actually succeeds in opening up the state again. And we have, as I said, we're working with Representative Reed, but we have some concerns that the same general counsels that we work for across the country who have shut down shipments into the state when they discovered that the prohibition was in place will agree that there are no barriers to being able to successfully collect and remit the tax, collect it from our customers, remit it to the state of South Dakota without jeopardy, without being put in a situation where they can't validate their tax base and prove to the Department of Revenue that they're paying on the proper tax base. And we know from the work that we do with these legal counsels that if they don't see a clear path to compliance, they will not permit their products to be shipped into South Dakota. They have done it with other states. In other states, there's been a couple of states in the last 2 years that have delivered a mandate to collect and remit the tax to their Department of Revenue. but have not been able to have not been given the tools to be able to effectively implement the bill. And in those states, one of two things has happened. Either they have stopped shipping into the state, or in the case of the state of Virginia, which just recently in a budget bill put the demand to collect and remit the tax in place, but without the tools, these companies simply notified the state of Virginia that they will not be collecting remitting the tax because they don't have a path to do so. So, as I said, we want to work with Representative Reed and the Senate committee to deliver a bill to the governor that actually does open the state up again. And if we get part of the way there now and the rest of the way there before the effective date, and can come back to you with changes to the bill, we'll continue to work whatever happens to this bill. But we want to see it pass the committee, and we want to see it pass the legislature.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for joining us remotely. We appreciate your participation.
You bet.
Are there further proponents for HB 1098? Further proponents? Seeing none, do we have any opponents to HB 1098? Any opponents? Seeing none, we'll open it up to committee questions. I can start. Representative Reed, I've got a question for you. Mr. Triplett brought up some concerns about industry and how that works with the state. Would you like to elaborate on your position, how you kind of view that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim Reed, District 7. What we want to do is get this bill in kind of what Mark was talking about. We want to get this bill completed and get it out with industry and see how it works. And I think that's what Mr. Triplett was talking about. And we will continue to discuss things. We've wrote this bill, so we know it works for South Dakota. So I think that's a good step one. And then step two is, okay, if it doesn't work with industry, then what kind of changes do we have to make? But let's pass the bill that works well for South Dakota, and then we'll figure out what if there is any changes that we have to make to work make it work for the industry. Thank you.
Senator Wheeler.
Thank you. So why the delayed effective date?
Mr. Chair, that's just to get so revenue has time to work through the licensing process, and so they're ready to go. So that's why there's a delay, to give them time to make sure everything is put in place properly.
A question along those same lines. Have we looked at how we can speed that up, or is it, just flat out not a possibility?
I really didn't ask. I was just happy to be able to get the bill done, so I went with the date that they wanted to do it. So,
Senator Stalzer.
And my first question is, the immunity we have on the floor, does that pertain to us in committee as well? And if I have to destroy those that have already been shipped here from somewhere, can I keep the humidor?
There's a Black Ford pickup out there. You just drop them off in there, and I'll make sure they get destroyed for you.
Tony Oliva's nephew, Jose, who's in the Florida legislature, they make some fine cigars.
Further questions on HB 1098? Seeing none, I would move it on to committee discussion and or action. Senator Wheeler.
I will move do pass.
We have a motion do pass from Senator Wheeler, a second from Senator Stalzer. Any discussion on that, Senator Wheeler? Senator Stalzer?
I didn't realize it was illegal, obviously.
Any further discussion before the Secretary calls the roll on the do pass motion? Seeing none, would the Secretary please call the roll?
Senators Foster?
Aye.
Nordstrom?
Aye.
Schoenbeck? Excused. Stalzer?
Aye.
Steinauer?
Aye.
Tobin?
Aye.
Zickmund?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye.
Crabtree?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, we have 8 of 9 yays and 1 excused.
HB 1090, after receiving the majority of the votes, HB 10 on for the do pass motion for HB 1098, will you hereby deem that passed, and we will also place that on the consent calendar. There's nothing, I think, that holds that one back. Thank you. All right. Moving on, HB 1074, an act to limit the liability regarding authorized boiler inspections. Senator Shane Fish.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Shane Fish, Senator for District 19. 48 states, including South Dakota, have laws that require inspections of boilers, which must be performed by either governmental inspectors or commission inspectors employed by the insurer writing coverage. Currently, insurance company inspectors are exposed to greater liability than the governmental inspectors doing the same type of work. This bill gives qualifying immunity for ordinary but not gross negligence to private sector inspectors. 8 states currently allow qualified immunity for boiler insurance inspection activities, and this bill also makes South Dakota one of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents for HB 1074. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Doug Abraham. I'm an attorney from Peer and a registered lobbyist for the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. A little background. APCIA represents nearly 60% of the property and casualty insurance market in the United States. And just for clarity, property insurance is just that. It provides coverage for personal and real property. Casualty insurance provides the liability coverage to help protect you if you're legally responsible for an accident that causes injuries to another person or damage to another's property. Now, 3 types of inspectors exist under South Dakota law, all detailed in Title 34, Chapter 29A. It was a surprise to me when I looked at this, but we have an entire chapter solely devoted to boiler inspection in South Dakota. There are chief and deputy inspectors that are state employees. There are also special inspectors, that's the third class, and that's the only class we're talking about here today, that are employees of an insurer. Now, this bill deals only with the special inspectors, and they are licensed specifically under 3429A-6. Those special inspectors must pass a state examination or hold a similar commission in a state with substantially equal standards as determined by the Department of Public Safety. Commissions are only in effect while the inspectors are employed by an insurer who writes boiler insurance. I think that's important. They don't go out, they don't inspect unrelated to the issuance of boiler insurance. And that's part of why we address that in this way in the bill, that only applies if the inspection is conducted incidental to the issuance or renewal of a boiler or machinery insurance. Special inspectors must follow the inspection program adopted by the Department of Public Safety under 3429A-16 and comply with those standards. Among the other standards and tests available, they may order hydrostatic testing if they determine it's necessary for a boiler or if they have some question about the functional ability of a boiler. Section 38 under that title and chapter requires inspection reports be issued, and that specific section requires that each company employing special inspectors meeting the requirements for licensure must, within 30 days following each certificate inspection made by the inspectors, file a report of the inspection with the Office of the State Fire Marshal upon appropriate forms as promulgated by the National Board of Boiler and Pressure Vessel Inspectors. Additionally, there's then a certificate issued after that inspection occurs. That's detailed under Section 39 of 3429A. Now, if the report that's filed in the previous section I mentioned shows the boiler is found to comply with the rules and regulations of the Department of Public Safety, then the chief inspector or his duly authorized representative shall issue to such owner or user an operation certificate bearing the date of inspection and specifying the maximum pressure under which the boiler may be operated. Now, these certificates that are issued pursuant to a special inspector's license are only effective while the boiler remains insured. And I think that's the most critical aspect of this entire section and chapter of code, is that these inspections are only in effect so long as you maintain insurance coverage. If you don't maintain insurance coverage for that boiler, you have to go back to the state and the state office and get an inspection there. So that certification is no longer in effect. And that's really what supports the public policy aspect of this, is that we want these boilers to be insured. Currently, when insurance company inspectors conduct these jurisdictional boiler inspections, they're exposed to extra contractual claims arising out of allegedly negligent acts or omissions during the inspection, reporting, and certification processes. Eight states currently afford liability protections for boiler insurance inspection activities. Five of those states, which are Indiana, Maine, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin, have longstanding laws that protect all insurer inspection activities from liability, while the three more recent laws, Arizona, which was a 2008 enactment, Tennessee, a 2010 enactment, and Oklahoma, which was a 2018 enactment, specifically address boiler inspections. Now, this bill ensures that protections for the special role of these inspectors exist, and this is a very unique section of law. Typically, our underwriting aspect and activities for insurers are not mandated under state law. Any underwriting that an insurer would take on would be on its own accord and wouldn't be subjected to a separate duty. Here, we've got a unique situation where we have a licensure of an inspector going out and completing a license that would otherwise be completed under state law. When you have and those state inspectors would be subjected to immunity depending on the office and then the coverage that may be afforded under the Office of Risk Management. So this special rule is unique. It's not really identified in any other section of code where we have private insurance inspectors taking on that state role. From a public policy standpoint, though, we should encourage this type of activity. It's good to have that insurance layer. Most of these property coverages are written as a package along with liability coverage. And as I indicated previously, that certification that is issued pursuant to this inspection is only in effect while that insurance is in place. This is the type of risk mitigation that benefits public policy, and it protects the important function that these inspectors play. So I'd encourage your support. I certainly will stand by for any questions. And we also have, if we could, Ken Stoller with APCIA. He's our national policy expert on boiler inspectors, available as well.
Thank you, Mr. Abraham. Are there further in-person proponents for HB 1074? Mr. Stoller, we will call on you as soon as we get through the in-person folks.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Craig Mattson, registered lobbyist for the South Dakota Insurance Alliance. I'm not going to take a lot of your time because I think Doug did a good job of explaining the bill. We not only think this is good public policy, we think it's smart public policy, and we hope that you can support it. Thank you.
Any further in-person proponents for HB 1074? Seeing none, Mr. Stoller.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Stoller. I am in-house counsel for the American Property Casualty Insurance Association, whose member companies write the majority of the insurance covering boilers and pressure vessels that provide essential power and heat to all businesses in South Dakota and nationwide. As has already been explained, virtually every state, including South Dakota, has laws that require periodic safety inspections of boilers. And has been brought out, which is unusual, and most people don't even realize it. Even I, having worked in the insurance industry for many years, didn't realize that either the government inspectors or the specially commissioned inspectors employed by the company insuring the boiler. This is mandatory in South Dakota that insurance companies perform the official state safety inspection of the boiler they insure. And the reason this came up, obviously, states have a strong interest in having these valuable inspections performed, but every state lacks the resources to adequately inspect every object covered under the boiler safety law. So while other types of inspections that insurers perform are solely for their own underwriting purposes, in order to determine whether to insure a property in the first place or how much premium to charge, like I said, insurers perform the official state safety inspections of the boilers they insure. And they are, as has already been explained, subject to lawsuits for their own alleged negligence, simply because they inspected a boiler and an adverse event such as a power surge or explosion later occurred, that was allegedly caused by something they did or didn't do during the inspection. I think it's important to note that what we're talking about here is the boiler and machinery insurance coverage specifically, which is also and more recently known as equipment breakdown coverage, which can cover items beyond the boiler. This is not the liability insurance that a boiler owner will have. A boiler owner can either, you know, maintain a liability insurance coverage or be self-insured. This is a separate product known as the equipment breakdown or boiler and machinery insurance coverage that, you know, that covers the, you know, the cost of doing expenses, but it also covers replacement or damage of damaged or destroyed equipment, loss of profits, and continuing expenses. Business interruptions, which may have occurred due to the equipment breakdown. So all HB 1074 will do is permit boiler insurers to continue performing these important safety inspections without having to deal with the significant extra expense and potential liability from direct lawsuits brought against them by third parties that are more appropriately focused on the boiler owner and either its self-insurance or its own liability insurance. So if a boiler insurer did or failed to do something that actually caused or contributed to the accident beyond simply inspecting a boiler at some point prior to the incident, it could still be subject to direct liability. And I won't, it's already been covered, you know, the number of states that already have this protection. You know, in some of the states, you know, the type of protection that we're suggesting, qualified immunity for ordinary but not gross negligence, that's actually in the statute for the state inspector's liability. And, normally we just tie it to that. Here, the liability of the state inspector is a little, it's kind of tied to sovereign immunity. So that's not something the private industry, would ask for. So that, you know, so that's kind of how the language is worded that way. But that's actually a common, level of immunity for state inspectors in other states. So thank you very much for considering this legislation. I'd be pleased to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stoller. We appreciate you joining us remotely. Are there any further proponents for HB 1074? Seeing none, we'll move on to opponents. Are there any opponents for HB 1074? Last call for opponents. No opponents. We will move on to committee questions. Are there any committee questions on HB 1074? I know it's a hot-button topic. Oh, too early for those jokes. Okay. All right. That was the best I had for boilers. I got more if I need them, Wheeler.
You better ask the pages if they have anything better. So.
any further questions, discussion, or action on HB 1074?
I will move to pass.
Second.
We have a do pass motion from Senator Wheeler, I think purely because he didn't want to hear any more of those jokes, and a second from Senator Foster. All right. Any further discussion on that, Senator Wheeler?
Seems like some common sense legislation to me.
Senator Foster? Anybody else in the committee? Seeing none, we have a do pass motion, and I would ask the Secretary to please call the roll.
Senators Foster?
Aye.
Northrup? Senator Northrup?
Aye.
Thank you. Schoenbeck excused. Stalzer?
Aye.
Steinauer?
Aye.
Tobin?
Aye.
Sickmund?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye.
Crabtree?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, we have 8 yeas, 0 nays, 1 excused.
All right, thank you. After receiving a majority of the votes, HB 1074 is hereby deemed passed and will be placed on the consent calendar. Okay, moving on, we will move HB 1113 up. This is revised certain references to the International Building Code. We discussed this last week. We're going to go ahead and start at the top and let our proponents give their pitch again, and then we'll go from there, as I know everybody had requested a little bit more time to study the issue. Good morning, Senator Duvall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Mary Duvall from District 24. This is a bill that comes in front of the legislature every few years or so. I would point out that it is permissive in nature, that if a local government wants to adopt the latest version of the International Building Code, they can amend it or ignore parts of it that they don't like. I would also point out in Section 2 of the bill, it talks about that this section does not apply to new construction for any one- or two-family dwelling, farmstead, similar things. However, there were questions about the actual code itself, and we have people here who know far more about it than I do. But I would ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Duvall. For the proponents for HB 1113.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I address both the bill and the amendment that's hanging out there?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yvonne Taylor with the South Dakota Municipal League, and we continue to support the bill 1113 in its current form, and we would ask you to resist the amendment. I did a fine job last week of proving that I'm an idiot, and so we have called in good people who can prove to you how good those local officials are that administer this program. And so I would ask to introduce those folks and have them explain exactly how this works on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents for HB 1113. Good morning, sir. Yeah, just hit your button. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tom Paisley. I'm the building official for the city of Spearfish. I'm the past president of South Dakota Building Officials Association and immediate past president of the International Code Council, Region 3, which is a five-state area. I brought the 2018 edition of the code so you can see it. Butch Warrington back here is going to show you the 2021 edition. They're very similar in size and nature. Little background about the International Code Council. In the 90s and prior, there were three model code groups in the United States. Those included BOCA, Building Officials Code Administrators. That was kind of your eastern states. Your Southern Building Code Congress International. That was your southern states. And then ICBO, International Code Conference of Building Officials, more of your western states. They each had code additions that we followed, and in 1997, the first international building code came out. Those three model code groups came together and formed the International Code Council. Butch and I try to attend annual business meetings. The only people that can vote for a code change are municipal employees such as us, code officials. You can submit a code change. I can submit a code change, but the only people that can actually vote on it are folks that are code officials. I would like to talk about the couple things. Insurance Services Office is a group that always comes to our town and everybody else's town that has codes, and they rate our building code effectiveness grading schedule. They give us a score, and if we get a good score, we get good insurance rates in our town. We get better scores by adopting the most recent edition of the codes. So that's why we do it. There's always new products coming out. There's new things that we look at. There's not a lot of significant changes here. Affordability is another reason these things are out there. You can build a building on a 4-inch concrete slab with a thickened edge and 2x4s, 2 foot on center with minimum wall bracing. The code just offers so many different types of options and wall bracing techniques that we're able to use, but we all look at these at our jurisdiction. We amend the code to fit our needs. Another thing is the South Dakota Board of Technical Professions in South Dakota has already have codified law that mandates certain buildings of certain sizes have to be designed by architects or engineers. For example, you might go to Butte County and build a large assisted living facility. That facility would have to be designed by an architect. Those architects need to know what kind of standard to look at to design those buildings. So I am hoping that we can convince you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those later. And thank you very much for having us here today.
Thank you, Mr. Paisley. We appreciate you making the trip over here. Further proponents for HB 1113. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. I have the current version that we would like to adopt.
Can you just... Yeah, give that to Senator Nordstrom. He needs some light reading. Can you just state your name?
I'm Butch Warrington. I'm representing myself. I am the chief building official for the city of Sioux Falls. With me is the 2021 IBC. Yes, we'd like to go to this and representing. There's some things that are going to change in this code. One of the big changes we have is I already have an architect talking to me about it. So I need some guidance, and this is for a multi-story building in Sioux Falls that they want to use wood construction on. Right now, I'm limited to four stories. They want to go bigger. Without something like this, it's very difficult to allow them to do that. You know, so that's one of the big changes, and the code is always changing, but anymore, it's a lot of more clarifications that there's been problems with in the past, so they clarify it to make sure that we're all doing it properly. There's three, like I said, three new types of construction for wood. This time it's called laminated timber, mass timber. You're going to be able to go to an 18-story wood frame building, and that's unheard of right now. There's 10 different occupancies in this code. Assemblies, healthcare, which is a group I, there's business offices, storage buildings, and this is where we get our guidance from on how large they can be depending on the construction type, and goes from there. And I'd like to talk about the amendment a little bit that we do amend the codes. Mainly, when I amend the code, it's to lessen the code. And a great example of that is Sioux Falls is just on the corner of the 250-mile-per-hour chart. Well, at 250-mile-per-hour, that means any school has to be constructed with a storm shelter. Storm shelters are very expensive at 250 miles an hour. I talked to architects and engineers about this. So the last code cycle, I dropped that down from 250 to 200 mile an hour. We looked at the data for the tornadoes around. We've never had one over 115 miles an hour. So I feel very comfortable allowing it to be constructed at 200 miles an hour versus 250 to save those our districts that money. In here, another amendment that I made after talking to all the school district areas around me, I made the decision to go from 20 square feet per occupant to 25 square foot per occupant, because the 20 square foot, you just didn't see classrooms that crowded. And this allowed them to make a little bit bigger classroom and only still have one exit. So that made a big difference to them. So I will be around for any questions you have, and thank you for listening to me today.
Appreciate you coming over. Further proponents for HB 1113. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, permission to remove my mask, please?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Justin Smith. I'm an attorney from Sioux Falls. I am the registered lobbyist for AIA South Dakota. AIA South Dakota is the professional trade association for the architectural profession in this state. Architects use the International Building Code in their plans and specifications constantly, particularly where the local governing body has exercised, as Senator Duval referred to it, their permissive authority to adopt and implement the International Building Code. We ask you to support House Bill 1113 in its current form. And, Mr. Chair, in a moment, if I may have permission to speak to the amendment as well.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. International Building Code is a comprehensive source of standards of safety, health, and overall design of buildings. The IBC is developed with input of recognized international experts in engineering, architecture, construction, and other professions involved with the construction industry. The due diligence and development of the IBC in any updates is a lengthy and detailed process with input, review, and comment by all of these various industry stakeholders. A new edition of the IBC is not adopted internationally until this exhaustive development and due diligence process is completed. Sometimes that process lasts years before a new edition of the IBC is implemented or adopted. We do not want to discourage innovation and advancement in designing and constructing buildings by ignoring these types of updated editions. We ask you to oppose the amendment that is currently on the system. As Senator Duval testified, these statutes are permissive, not mandatory, meaning we do not need a massive change to the statutes in the way the amendment would propose. The existing statutes say if the governing body adopts, it may amend, modify, or delete any portion of the IBC. So at the end of the day, these are a set of comprehensive international standards that can be taken into a local community to make sure that our process of building, the standards that apply to all of those interior issues, are going to be governed by recognized authority that has been fully vetted by all industry stakeholders in the process. This bill, as presented without the amendment, is very simple and straightforward. We have trusted the IBC in South Dakota for many years. We ask you to continue that process. Please pass 1113 and reject the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents for HB 1113? Seeing none, we will move on to opponents. Are there any opponents for HB 1113? Seeing none, we will move this on to committee questions. Senator Nordstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have some questions. I apologize for not knowing the name of the gentleman from Sioux Falls that is a building code person.
Mr. Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'd allow me some latitude with lots of questions.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Just be nice, would you?
All right. Mr. Chairman, that's my natural mode. take me through the process. In other words, a lot of it is a timing issue for my question, and that is somebody says, I'm going to build a new building, and we've got this code in place, and then somewhere during that process, the code changes from the 18 version to the 21 version. What standard am I held to?
Whenever, the way we do it is whenever that permit was issued, that's the code it's stuck on. So if it's issued under the 18 code, even though I adopt the 21, they're still going to be allowed to build it under the 2018 code.
Mr. Chairman, in following up with your advice to be nice, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Further questions?
Go ahead.
Say we get partway through the, now that we've agreed upon which code book we're following, which is helpful, very helpful to have that frozen. The other question is, halfway through the process, we find something that every knowledgeable person agrees that that is a bad idea and it's expensive. Say it adds $30,000 to the project. And we all know, and you know, and everybody knows that the code is forcing us to spend $30,000 and we're not getting anything in return for that $30,000. Where do we go from there?
Mr. Chair, if I, in a case like that, I can do it administratively, depending on what it is. Of course, we look at everything. We look at why it is, what's the intent of the code in that situation. If I make a bad decision or they don't agree with me, I have a building board of appeals they can appeal it to. And if they don't agree with the building board of appeals, then they can take it to circuit court.
Mr. Chairman, so during the process, things are time sensitive because you've got contracts with all the subcontractors, and this has to start on June 1, and this has to start on July 1st. The question is, how do we expedite that so that the whole project doesn't come to a screeching halt while we go through that process?
Mr. Chair. What I have found is most of the time they won't take it any farther because of that time sensitive. That's the reason we do a plan review at the beginning of the project. So we find all those little quirks out before they start building.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Steinhauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burrington, thank you for being here and making the trip. You live this day in and day out, so you're probably aware. I had heard a few years ago, I think probably when we were adopting the 18 code, because I was in the legislature at that time and got on my soapbox about what it's doing maybe to the cost of construction, is that at a national level, there was a movement to require sometime in the 20s that there would be a cost estimate of what the change might do to a typical, I think it was a home at that time. Have you heard anything happening on a national level to try and get a cost estimate with the change in codes?
Mr. Chair, I have not heard anything. Usually when a code adoption is changed on the national level, they will give us a rough idea as far as this is a significant cost or there is no cost to it, and that's about all I see.
Follow up. So then that's good news that you're getting some indication when the code comes out that says this change is a higher cost change, so that when you're reviewing what to do in the city of Sioux Falls, you understand the ramifications of adopting that particular aspect or not. Is that what I understood?
Mr. Chair, yes. When I go to the national convention to vote on these, that is all taken into consideration.
Senator Nordstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we consider 2021, how would you classify the cost of implementing that? As you used the words, I think, significant and insignificant, probably.
Mr. Chair, I would hate to say because it depends on the building. Because some buildings, they aren't even allowed to do it right now. That's one of the neat parts about the code. Like I was talking earlier, you're going to be able to use a wood construction building that can go quite tall. That wouldn't be allowed right now. So how do you compare that to the metal building? I can't give you an answer there. An architect would be able to give you a better answer than I could.
Thank you.
Further questions? Any further committee questions on HB 1113? Seeing none, we'll let Mr. Warrington off Senator Nordstrom's hot seat there. So we'll open it up to committee discussion and or action. Senator Wheeler.
I will move do pass.
We have a motion do pass from Senator Wheeler, second from Senator Zickman. Any discussion on that, Senator Wheeler?
It's permissive and allows municipalities to use the up-to-date code, and I think that's an important thing to allow them to do.
Senator Zickman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to thank the gentleman for coming in this morning. You know, this is kind of a new thing because there's always a first for everything. And it's good that we have had a lot of questions and et cetera, and I appreciate you folks coming in because it's a long way from Sioux Falls, right, and from Spearfish. So, but I think this is it's a good bill. It's brought in. I want to thank Senator Duvall for her effort and everybody that's testified for the bill. It's a good bill without the amendment, and let's move it forward. I think I would hope that the good senator from Aberdeen would be able to spend a little time with these two gentlemen and review the text that they have brought with them and let him see what that code really looks like. So, but thank you, gentlemen, for coming in. So let's move the bill forward.
Senator Steinhauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be supporting the motion. I never intended to not support the passage of this bill, but I wanted to get on my soapbox, and I apologize for making some people drive up here. But I would suggest, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, that to those that are involved on a daily basis. When you go to these national meetings or your regional meetings, I know it might be like pushing on a rope, but let's continue to push for a better understanding of the costs that they might drive, because we don't have the ability to estimate the costs. I suspect you don't, because they're intertwined. And if I can take just a minute, Mr. Chair, before I retired from my day job, I was a senior executive of a company that made window and door components. I want you all to think about your windows in your house. How many times do you open them? The requirement for a window right in 2014 when I retired was that the window, that it's a hung window, had to be able to cycle 4,000 times without failing. And there was a movement to increase that. Think about 4,000 times and how long that window is going to last. How does that happen? And it ends up in the International Building Code. Well, there's an organization called the Fenestration and Glazing Alliance. And then there's the Window and Door Manufacturing Association. So if you think about the people that make windows and doors, there might be letter A and M and P and J that are all making windows. And they are members of the Window and Door Manufacturing Association. They come and say, hey, we've got a new way. We can get it to 5,000 cycles. We should up the requirement to 5,000. Why? Because it gives them a competitive advantage, because some of the smaller guys can't do it yet. Over time, those standards for that door go up. And there's what this WDMA and the FIGA organization do is they set standards for air and water and structural integrity of that window. Air and water means, can when you put it in a wind tunnel and you're blowing water at it, does water and air come through it? And if you think about it, in the International Building Code, those individuals that are very concerned about the thermal performance of a window or a door are looking to up that if they're concerned about global warming, and especially, and again, it's an international building code, but it also sets the structural requirements, and that's the cycling time. So they adopt a standard which is adopted by the North American Alliance Fenestration Standards, and when it gets to the IBC, it's got to meet NAF standards. So now, as an inspector, when you go out, you're probably looking for a window that says it's got NAFs, or it meets NAF standards. So you'll follow that all the way back. We've got individuals in the industry that are driving up the cost for competitive advantage there by requiring the standards to go up. That happens in windows and doors. It's happening in everything, and it's like a plate of spaghetti. You know, you pull on one strand, and you don't know where it goes. But over time, we continue to drive up the cost. And the reason I get on my soapbox is when I understand that this is a permissive code. Not everybody is as sophisticated as two gentlemen here, and cities might have inspection. They're just blanketly accepting it and aren't taking the steps that Mr. Warrington is doing to ignore certain aspects or to drop them down. But I'm not even sure if they know that windows are supposed to cycle 4,000 times, and there's a push to make it 6,000. Those things drive the cost of our homes, and it's going on, and we need to get federal involvement to push costs, and that's why I keep getting on my soapbox. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Steinhauer. Senator Nordstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been on the Commerce Committee a few years, and I've seen a few of these presentations, and this is the best one I've seen in terms of actually justifying the building code. So I commend the gentleman that testified in favor of it. Also, I do provide a service to the lobbyists, because without me, they'd be unemployed. So they should be more appreciative. I think I account for about half of Yvonne's salary. So anyway, I do worry about, I understand the need for building codes. I think building codes, we would be a third world country if we didn't have building codes. So I'm okay with building codes. I guess my pushback is always related to, was it customized for South Dakota? Was it specialized? And when we do find something that's somebody pushed through that doesn't make sense economically, can we find a way to get that back out of the code? And it sounds like that's a possibility that we can fix those problems, although I did hear the testimony that says during the construction we're on a timeline and it's hard for us to slow down and have that due process. So I'll be voting no. I've got a reputation to defend, and but my pushback is always related to, do we understand the code? And obviously these gentlemen do, and that's a good thing. But I also know that there was some testimony that said we're not sure of the cost, and I understand that's a massive question mark. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I would wrap up by just saying I appreciate both Senator Steinhauer and Senator Nordstrom for hitting the brakes on this a little bit last week. I think we provide a lot of clarity, so I appreciate those who joined us from Sioux Falls and Spearfish to share your vision on this. I think we are all in favor of reducing regulation, as Senator Steinhauer alluded to. That decreases the cost of workforce housing especially, but certainly further development. I think what we learned here today was this doesn't necessarily increase red tape, but also brings to light some new innovation. I know when you're talking about a person that had been involved in some developments that didn't go forward in Sioux Falls at the time because wood construction couldn't go taller than four stories. So to hear that today is fantastic. So I think that's going to open up a lot of possibilities in some of our bigger communities, and that's just one of probably many examples. So that's exciting news, and thank you for taking that on. And so the lastly, as I thought was important, is how they come in and they rate the insurance services. So that's going to drive our commercial costs for insurance up or down, and meeting this is going to drive that down or keep that down as low as possible for our folks. So I think that's a good thing. So what's on the table right now is a do-pass motion from Senator Wheeler, and that was seconded by Senator Zickman. I'd ask the Secretary to please call the roll.
Senators Foster?
Aye.
Nordstrom?
No.
Schoenbeck?
Aye.
Stalzer?
Aye.
Steinhauer?
Aye.
Tobin?
Aye.
Zickman?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye.
Crabtree?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, we have 8 yeas, 0 nays. I'm sorry, 1 nay. Nope. So we have 8-1.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. After receiving a majority of the votes, HB 1113 is hereby deemed passed. Following that, I would ask, Senator Schoenbeck.
I just have a question. Were we supposed to get those haircuts all the way down? Because I didn't get the memo.
We'll get you hooked up. And I think Senator, Wheeler's lining up haircuts for Senator Schoenbeck, and Senator Foster, I think, is bringing jerky for the phone deal. So I would entertain a motion to adjourn. All right, we got a first by Senator Nordstrom, seconded by Senator Steinhauer. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. We are adjourned. Thank you.